scenarios may be changed over the hour, as I said. So the real issue here is that from the U.S. point of view, Russia is not really an enemy because it's no more a threat. The real problem for the U.S. is China. And everything was being directed. We remember also heavy requests to Europeans to participate in Indo-Pacific operations and increase their presence over there, and all the moves that were taking place in that area in terms of alliances and so on. I would say that perhaps we can also imagine that what is happening in Ukraine is something that diverts the attention from the area and therefore calms down the animosity against Russia, against China, and concentrates it on the old-fashioned European juxtaposition with Russia and therefore what is going on. So, but these are scenarios that are being imagined. Nobody really knows what is in the head of Putin or of the Pentagon, and therefore Europeans are caught in the middle, and they will pay a lot, as it was said by the other colleague, in terms of economic costs of this crisis.
Right. And Vladimir, if I can pose that same million-dollar question to you as well, how do you see the next few days or perhaps the next few weeks unfolding in Eastern Europe?
It's a big unknown. I think that I suspect that the Russians will stop within a week their military campaign, but this is just the beginning. They're going to leave Ukraine. What they're going to do, you know, I don't think it's that easy for them to bring some politician who will be good for them, but, you know, will Ukraine accept it? I don't think they can stay and occupy there. This is not their intention. If they back off, It's not quite clear. One hope, you know, ideally that's maybe that was their hope, that Zelensky will make a peace quickly and agreed or not sort of pushing for NATO, and that will be the end of it. But you know, it's not happening. So I don't foresee anything particularly good for anyone in this story.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guests for their time and their contribution. Professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University, Vladimir Goldstein, joined us from Providence in Rhode Island, and Paolo Raffoni, the co-founder and CEO at the CPE Foundation, joined us live also from the Belgian capital, Brussels. And with that, we bring an end to another edition of the Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim Ali Himani and Sheikh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, brother.
Assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Let's get to today's topic, which is the foundation of family in Islam. Why the religion of Islam emphasizes very much on establishing the family, taking the wife and having children, but inside the wedlock, which is the legitimate Shari'i system of thought, something which is unfortunately very much missed in the nowadays liberal capitalist lifestyle of the Western world. Sheikh Qasim, let's start with you. Why so much emphasis on establishing a family?
Yeah, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم, بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. First of all, I think, actually there are many aspects that we can't actually talk about with respect to the importance of family. Let's talk about the social effects of family. The first and the most maybe important block or the institution of social institutions actually is family. So the social life of a person starts in his or her family.
Yes.
So it's so important, actually, that person that is born into that family is going to be reared by his or her father and mother, parents in that family, and the upbringing that is receiving starts from that institution, and it's going to affect the whole life of this person, you know. So that's one of the actually aspects of the importance of the institution of family.
Okay.
Another one is that, all those developments and progress mm-hmm. that a person can go through and achieve can be flourish in his or her family. And so that's actually another aspect of the importance of family.
So not any single man or woman who are living under one ceiling in one house can be considered as a family in Islam.
Yeah.
This is something, unfortunately, we can see in the newer styles of the family, in the world nowadays, which is out of the old style, as they call it, type of the families and the family foundation around the world.
Yeah. Okay. Not all of them. We may have some families that have lost their father or mother and their families. But the ones that are not actually intending to have the whole members of a regular family, yeah. So that are not actually regarded not only by religions but even by the convention of human beings from the very beginning.
Exactly.
Yeah, that so is not the
it's,
way.
It's just not about Islam. If you look at all the cultures around the world, yes. the ancient mm. cultures and the cultures right before this yes. Neo-modern world, all cultures encouraged marriage and considered it to be a holy and sacred yeah. thing. They had a perspective that this is a sacred thing. Not just that, if you look at psychology, you look at Abraham Maslow, he says, look, human beings have some basic needs. And he yes. starts off the hierarchy. In the hierarchy, he says, you have the basic needs, food, water, shelter, and sex. And then he says, next is your security needs, that you need to feel secure. And third, and the most important one, is your social needs. And he says, you need to live in an institution. You need to be connected with people. And this is where marriage comes into perspective. Mm. So it's not just about Islam. It's all cultures around the world that consider marriage as an important aspect of human life and consider it to be a very sacred thing.
The case is with this sacredness of the family, because nowadays you could find it in the media and this new style of the family that they are violating this sacredness of the family. They want to take it out, this sacredness, and make it as something... Okay, one man and woman, or two men, or two women, you know, a single parent, you know, they can leave. And this is also a family. For example, if a mother takes care of a child and works out as a single parent without marrying, for example, a man, this also could be seen as a family. I do want to say, what are the negative aspects of this look at the family? At last, they might say that in the Western type of lifestyle, all these type of new families fit. And they fit exactly into the new lifestyle of the people. We have no problem with that. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, actually, you know, the thing, I believe that your, you know, the stress of your idea is on the, you know, the coexistence or the cohabitation of, for example, two persons. From you know the same sex or from you know different sex,
yes.
Whether they have child or not,
okay.
You know that you know the problem that actually is with that sort of life is that it actually it's not based you know and promoting such lives you know is not is just is based on the way that the West actually looks at the things, and it's. Originated in the strategies that the Western culture, unfortunately, for the last 3-4 centuries, maybe more than that, are based upon and laid out actually on those foundations, which is you know the importance of interest and pleasure. So that is yes. that is the you know
the sexual satisfaction,
not just the sexual satisfaction. You know,
so what do you mean by pleasure?
Whatever you know, your interest. So that is actually in the philosophy. This the philosophy of politics.
Okay.
It was John Stuart Mill who started actually this trend and this movement.
Mm, yes.
That it's the most pleasure, the most
benefit. You
benefit
take.
For yes. the majority of the people.
Yes,
and. Actually, they didn't abide by that too. You know, it was not for the majority. You know, soon after the majority of people turned into the minority of people.
Yes.
So now we see that you know, the values of the Western countries are in favor of a minority over there, and they are actually sacrificing whatever stands in front of that ideology that they have. You know, that this strategy, the Western strategy of the interest and the
recently there was a documentary made about Harry Potter, and the interesting point was that the main author of the Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, was not in that documentary. Now the audience asked why, because J.K. Rowling is against LGBT. See?
Interesting.
she was against, and the producer did not let her in because she supported recently another black writer, you know, who was against LGBT. So many other artists too, for example, in the media, in the cinema, in the movie, in the cinematic form, the artistic form, those people who are against LGBT have no place. They will lose their jobs, okay?
Yeah.
And again, I do want to say, These new formats that day by day through media, television, especially the movies that they are making, it's changing the thoughts of the people around the world that let's experience new forms of cohabitation or relationship with the same gender or with the opposite gender. And this is, a tragedy for the world.
See,
the foundation of the family is missing its place day by day.
See, you're true about this, but, you know, people need to do a little bit of research,
mm-hmm.
and that'll help them a lot. You know, if you do a little research, you will realize that all this is part of their social experimentation.
No.
Let me quote one of the documentaries. It's called Century of Self. It's got four parts to it by Edward Bernays. By another guy. The main character he's portraying there is about Edward Bernays, how he approached the whole scenario there. So there he talks about this social experimentation that they conducted in America, and that led to the hippie culture. And he uses a term in that documentary. He says sex revolution.
Oh.
He says, he clearly uses the term, and yes. He says, look, people earlier were bound to their family. They were living within the family.
Yes.
And then they felt that, the limitation of not being able to get involved with others. And as part of the social experimentation, they were told they were T-groups, focused T-groups where they were allowed to open up and speak and do whatever they want.
Okay.
And then encouraged to mix with more than one person at a time. And then suddenly they felt the freedom to be able to do it and didn't see it as a taboo anymore. And then suddenly the whole environment turned into that hippie culture and sex revolution.
Yes.
And then they also realized that being bound to one person, and let's say it was the mistake to marry one person, but they realized that commitment was one of their problems.
Yes.
They're scared to commit to one person. And that's why they feel that let's not commit to anyone. I will live with this person. If I like him, I'll carry on for another 40, 50, 60 years. But somewhere in between, I find him not compatible with me.
Okay.
I'm not committed to this person. So I can quickly leave this person and go. So this is part of their social experimentation that they rolled it out in a planned approach.
The same revolution that made, increased the rate of drug use.
Correct.
Especially after Vietnam War.
Correct.
Also abortion,
Correct.
Wow. Out of children, out of wedlock. How many children out of wedlock because of the sex revolution in the U.S.? And when the sociologists, and psychologists take a look back at that period, say that this is the darkest age and darkest time for the U.S. citizens around the world. And, just a simple look at the pictures and the lifestyle of the people, even in the U.S. before 60s, 50s, you could find such haya and modesty, even in the clothing.
Exactly.
See?
Yeah.
But nowadays, as naked as an animal. Is it so?
I'll allow Sheikh Qasim to answer that.
Yes.
But not just West, Brother Atta.
Yes.
You would see that attitude even in the East. If you go back and look at the pictures of women in India 50 years ago.
Shrouded, yes.
Yeah, they would actually cover the head.
Yes.
They would actually pull their covering over the head so much further down that it literally covered their face, more like a niqab, right?
Yes, yes.
So the Hindu culture also had something called covering the head and covering the face to the extent of niqab.
Yes.
But then it's the exploitation of the Western culture.
The chastity.
Exactly.
The
so that led to the desanctifying the chastity of women and, encouraging them to reveal more and cover less.
I think we've been talking about the philosophy or, the underlying layers of this sort of actually deviation in the West and, as you said, even in the East. And again, I believe that's the way that they look at this world, and they are actually looking at the people like, some workers that are there in order for working for them. So the more they are committed, the less they work,
Okay.
So I think that works to their interest in the best way by having, promoting the ways of lives that have less commitment. So these sorts of relationships out of wedlock.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Qasim, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Color of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Color of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention, as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees, since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet, in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often, and those administrations are subject to changing their positions from the last administration, then you find that Iran doesn't have any solid guarantees.
Iran says America's maximum pressure campaign has failed and its credibility has been seriously deterred. Observers believe Washington now has to take measures to compensate for its past mistakes and regain the trust of the international community.
The Israeli regime has carried out yet another attack on the Syrian capital Damascus's countryside, killing three soldiers. Syria's state television carried the report early on Thursday, specifying the assault as a missile attack. Various media outlets had earlier reported that Syria's air defenses had confronted an Israeli airstrike around Damascus. The official Syrian Arab news agency Sana said a number of explosions had rung out over the skies of the capital and its outskirts. This is the Israeli regime's fourth attack on the Syrian soil within the space of just 2 weeks.
They consider they have the military, the diplomatic edge, and really every solution for the Israelis is not peace, but it's a technical ability to dominate and control the Palestinians.
Just a day earlier, the Arab countries said the regime had launched a missile attack on various targets on the outskirts of Syria's southwestern city of Quneitra near Syria's Tel Aviv-occupied Golan Heights. Last week, the occupying regime targeted areas surrounding Damascus and the western city of Homs.
Well, Israel pays no attention to international law. It doesn't even, I don't think, make a pretense of it. It violates international law every day in regard to the airspace of Lebanon, the airspace of Syria, the rights of the Palestinian people, and of course in its threats against Iran.
Israel frequently targets military positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance movement Hezbollah, which has played a key role in helping the Syrian army in its fight against the foreign-backed terrorists. Tel Aviv regime claims that its attacks target alleged supplies that are headed for the Lebanese resistance movement of Hezbollah. On countless occasions, though, the strikes have targeted reinforcement belonging to Syria's military and its allies. Tel Aviv mostly keeps quiet about its attacks on Syrian territories. Many view them as a knee-jerk reaction to the Syrian government's increasing success in confronting terrorism.
Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower, of the region as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States. It wishes to be the dominant military force that actually exists as a country in the region. And I think that that's really what's going on here. It has nothing to do with international law, which is, as I said, Israel ignores.
Israel has been a key supporter of terrorist groups that have opposed the government of President Bashar al-Assad since the foreign-backed militancy erupted in Syria in March 2011.
Our position on the status of the Golan Heights is well known, and we would like to make it clear that this position has not changed. In line with international law and relevant Security Council resolutions, notably Resolution 242 and 497, we do not recognize Israel's sovereignty over the territories occupied by Israel since June 1967, including the Golan Heights, and we do not consider them to be part of the territory of the State of Israel. Annexation of territory by force is prohibited under international law.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's continued occupation of the Golan. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as one of its launch pads for attacks against the Syrian soil.
Britain has sought to restore its influence and colonial rule in West Asia by pursuing aggressive and interventionist policies in the region. UK's first direct military involvement, the 21st century, began in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. UK officials beat the drums of war. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was referred to as George W. Bush's poodle, played a key role in paving the way for UK's militarism. It has now emerged that British forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Documents show senior military officers buried evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. UK Special Forces officers killed unarmed Afghans who posed no threats. In 2003, London followed Washington's lead in accusing Iraq's former regime of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
So that was the UK's role, was to provide cover for the Americans. And of course, the UK sees America as a means of getting a sort of protection, getting the big brother on their side, which they've, you know, following on from their experiences in 1945, the British establishment have a terrific fear of being left on their own to face a major continental enemy.
The UK, alongside the US, invaded Iraq without the UN mandate. British forces were primarily stationed in southern Iraq. British soldiers tortured hundreds of Iraqi detainees between 2003 and 2009. But no action was taken to hold the British government accountable for the war crimes that it committed there. Following the invasion of Iraq, an inquiry team was set up to investigate Britain's military intervention in the Arab nation. The Chilcot report said the UK chose to invade Iraq before peaceful options had been exhausted. It also said the former UK Premier, Blair, exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It also said that Blair ignored warnings on what would happen in Iraq after its invasion.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
London is one of Saudi Arabia's staunch supporters. UK-made weapons are used by the Saudi regime against the Yemeni people. The UK is one of Saudi Arabia's leading arms suppliers, along with the US. It is also a major supplier of arms to the United Arab Emirates, another country in the coalition that is bombing Yemen. The UK has continued to support airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. It has provided both arms and ongoing maintenance and support, in spite of overwhelming evidence of repeated breaches of international humanitarian law by the coalition.
Well, its colonial interest is historical. I don't believe that anyone is trying to get Lawrence of Arabia back into the peninsula anymore. I don't think the British, even the most purblind British, don't think they can recreate the empire.
The UK-made equipment used in the war includes Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Paveway bombs, and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles. The published value of UK arm licenses for export to the Saudi-led coalition since the bombing began in 2015, in March, is £8.4 billion. However, estimates show that the real value of arms to Saudi Arabia is over £20 billion, while the value of sales to the coalition as a whole is over £22 billion.
Such hideous weaponry, and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
It is now believed that given the U.S. withdrawal from the West Asia region, or minimal presence, the U.K. is moving in to replace the U.S. while pursuing to restore its colonial influence and role in the West Asia region.
Around a month ago, Israeli media reported that the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has increased its drone activities in Israeli airspace. The drone operations were mainly for gathering intel. Last Friday, the Israeli military activated the Iron Dome and scrambled fighter jets, but failed to intercept a drone from Lebanon. As a result, air raid sirens were sounded in the north, and later it was announced that Israeli fighter jets were spotted flying low over Beirut. Hezbollah later released a statement saying the drone named Hassan entered Israeli airspace on a reconnaissance mission at a depth of 70 kilometers for around 40 minutes before returning untouched. This was the second incident in as many days and comes after Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah said the group was making its own drones in Lebanon. Pointing to Israeli threats, the Hezbollah chief said the enemies only threaten others with war, but they know it will be very difficult and costly for them. He said Hezbollah is capable of upgrading the quality of its rockets to fend off Israeli threats. In fact, Hezbollah has been increasing its fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, and now it is estimated to have some 2,000 UAVs. Based on Israeli media reports, Hezbollah is also in possession of over 100,000 rockets, and Israel's existing missile systems neither are capable of intercepting such a number of missiles and rockets, nor can protect Israeli settlers. The launch of the radio-controlled aircraft on Friday seems like a message from Hezbollah. Even if the Israeli military sometimes manages to shoot down Hezbollah's UAVs or drones, the resistance movement can keep sending them into Israel at will. If Israel believes it is free to violate Lebanese sovereignty with UAVs and fighter jets, Hezbollah will do the same south of the border.
It is interesting to see how fragile its entire military industrial complex actually is, and the latest event has just showed it once again that even though the Israeli regime is investing so many efforts in its so-called defense, it remains very weak, and it is the Lebanese resistance that continues to show the Israeli regime its own weakness.
Previously, retired Israeli General Yitzhak Brek warned that the Israeli military is not ready for any future war, especially a multi-front one. He predicted that in an extreme scenario, the resistance movements in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, as well as Hamas in the Gaza Strip, will launch missiles and drones at Israel, so that the average number of rockets fired at the regime will reach 3,000 a day. Atuit reports during the Israel-Palestine conflict in May, when Israel's official military data indicated that the Iron Dome only destroyed fewer than half of the rockets and mortars fired by Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements toward Israel. Therefore, in case of an all-out war, the Israeli regime would be vulnerable. While Tel Aviv sees its power waning, the resistance front has managed to increase its prowess. This is while Israel is trying to sell the Iron Dome missile system to Arab nations, but how can the Iron Dome work for them when it did not work for Israel?
This is why the entire existence of the so-called State of Israel in its current form necessitates the ongoing killing of people and ongoing expansion of its military complex. But at the same time, of course, it remains fragile. This is a very existential contradiction within the Israeli colony that eventually will also probably lead to its to the fall of the apartheid regime and the Israeli hegemony, supposed hegemony in the region.
The editor-in-chief of Rayal Yom newspaper, Abdel Bari Atwan, says a small drone that is worth only $100 manages to penetrate into Israel's airspace, despite the Tel Aviv regime's costly military equipment and the Iron Dome system. He says Persian Gulf Arab states that are racing to buy this system from Israel should give it a second thought after the regime's failure against the Hezbollah resistance movement's drones.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Martyrdom of the Seventh Imam. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, Salam and welcome to the program. We offer heartfelt condolences to our listeners on a very doleful day, which the faithful commemorate every year on the 25th of the month of Rajab. Today is the tragic day when the Prophet's seventh infallible heir was martyred in Baghdad through a fatal dose of poison during imprisonment by the usurper Abbasid regime in 183 AH, corresponding to 799 AH. He reposes in eternal peace in the sprawling twin-domed gold-plated shrine of Qazimain, where people flock day and night and pay their respects to him by saluting him in an appropriate manner, such as, "Peace on you, O representative of Allah and the son of his representative. Peace on you, O the decisive argument of Allah and the son of his decisive argument. Peace on you, O light of Allah in the darkness of the ignorant world. Peace on you, O guide who showed the right path. Peace on you, O symbol of religion and piety. Peace on you, O treasurer of the wisdom of the prophets. Peace on you, O vicegerent of the guardians of the past. Peace on you, O depository of the manifest revelations. Peace on you, O possessor of certitude knowledge. Peace on you, O treasury of the messenger's knowledge. Peace on you, O murdered martyr. Peace on you, O son of the messenger of Allah and the son of his successor. Peace on you, O my lord Musa ibn Ja'far." What you heard were phrases from the special ziyarat, or standard form of salutations, for the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Named Musa in honor of Prophet Moses, peace upon him, he acquired the epithet of Qazim, or the patient one who refrains from anger, in view of the vicissitudes of life through which he passed during the 35 years of his mission. Born in Abwa between the holy cities of Mecca and Medina in the year 128 AH, corresponding with 745 AD, he was only 55 years old when, Harun, while immersed in pleasures in Raqqa in Syria, sent a fast-paced emissary to Baghdad to instruct the despicable jailer, Sindi bin Shahak, to kill the Prophet's heir in such a way that no sign would remain of any foul deed on the body of the victim. It is an irony of Islamic history that charlatans, debauchees, apostates, and infidels masqueraded as caliphs and made Muslims forcibly obey their will by distorting the tenets of religion, while the divinely designated heirs of the Prophet and the inheritors of the pure and pristine Sunnah Wasira, that is, the practice and behavior of the Messenger of God, were persecuted. After having martyred Imam Musa Kazim, peace upon him, the assassin had the court officials testify with signatures on a long scroll that no foul acts had been done and the venerable prisoner had died on a natural death. Sindi then left the corpse on the bridge over the river Tigris unattended. Were the people of Baghdad Muslims? Did they adhere to the practice and behavior of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny? Didn't they know that the corpse was that of the son and successor of the Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him? Then why didn't they oppose the Abbasids? The answers to such questions are obvious. Muslim conscience had died long ago, ever since the caliphate was hijacked at Saqifa Bani Sa'de in Medina by a group of usurpers, while the Prophet still lay unburied and while his bereaved Ahlul Bayt or immediate family members, whose authority and purity God himself has vouchsafed in the noble Quran, were busy in the state of mourning performing the last rites of the seal of messengers. So there is nothing to be surprised at the attitude of self-styled Muslims, whether in the past, when the chosen ones of God were brutally martyred, or at present, when innocent and defenseless men, women and children are either mercilessly bombed by Saudi aircraft in Yemen or torn to pieces by bomb blasts in Afghanistan, triggered by Daesh terrorists who shamelessly called themselves Muslim. The faithful, however, remain undaunted. They adhered firmly to the God-given political and spiritual rights of Imam Ali, peace upon him, as proclaimed by the Prophet, and they provided burial to the seventh Imam in Baghdad while assisting his son and successor Imam Reza, peace upon him, who miraculously came from Medina to conduct the last rites of his father. These days as well, despite the dastardly acts of the Takfiri heretics and their terrorist masters, the Americans, the faithful are flocking to the shrine of Imam Musa Kazim, peace upon him, in Qasimain, north of Baghdad, in millions to pay homage. It will not be out of context to cite a passage from Imam Musa Kazim's lengthy sermon to his disciple, the master theologian Hisham ibn Hakam, regarding God-given wisdom and authority. O Hisham, the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, peace upon him, used to say, "No one should sit in the forefront of a session except those who can answer when they are questioned, speak when others cannot, and have the most satisfying opinion. He who does not enjoy these three characters and allows himself to sit in the forefront of a session is surely idiot." These are mind-stimulating words indeed. The passage that you heard instantly turns our attention towards not only the Mosque of Kufa, where Imam Ali, peace upon him, the Prophet's divinely designated vicegerent, used to enlighten minds and souls, but also towards the fate of those in history who ended up becoming eternally damned idiots by making the fatal mistake of usurping the caliphate and sitting in the place of the Ahlul Bayt. Thus, Imam Musa Kazim, peace upon him, as an heir of the Almighty's last and greatest prophet, spared no efforts to spread the truth, even if it meant speaking directly to a tyrannically murderous caliph, such as Harun, who longed for lasting glory, but ended up in the bowels of hell with no sign on earth of his rotten grave, while his victim reigns supreme from Baghdad, where the Shia and Sunni Muslims alike salute at the site of the seventh Imam's shrine with the words, Ya Bab al-Hawa'ij, or O Gateway of Boons. His manners were impeccable. Never was he heard speaking roughly or harshly to anyone. Even in the most unpleasant situations, he was seen smiling and bearing the pain gracefully. This was in accordance with the saying of his ancestor Imam Ali, peace upon him, that the faithful keeps his grief confined in his heart while a smile on his face. It is an irony of Islamic history that such a noble person was harassed, imprisoned, and martyred. Here is another passage from the Ziyarat of Imam Musa Kazim, peace upon him, as food for thought. I bear witness that you carried and delivered that for which Allah has commissioned you, protected that which was entrusted to you, prescribed that which Allah has made lawful, forbade that which Allah has made unlawful, made clear the divine rules, studied and interpreted the book of Allah, exercised self-control for the sake of Allah, strived in the cause of Allah, leaving no stone unturned till the inevitable came unto you. I have taken refuge near your grave. Your zarih is my sanctuary. You are my advocate before Allah. I am a friend of your friends. I am averse to your enemies, well acquainted with your rank and the guidance you adhere to, mindful of the depravity of your opponents and of the waywardness in which they are wandering.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
Necessity of urging piety alongside learning. You gentlemen and others, wherever they are and are involved in this noble profession of imparting learning to our nation and this oppressed nation that was deprived of everything during the previous regime, while they would continually talk about glory and civilization, and their nation was inundated in ignorance. You that today have endeavored to impart literacy to the people must take note that the worth of your task has been upheld by the glorious Quran. However, alongside this teaching, there should also be development. There should be a call to piety.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You're listening to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the search of Islam. In one of his speeches, where he is emphasizing on the search of Islam, he mentions to the nation, and he says that the nation which wants itself and everything it possesses for Islam shall be victorious. Now, in this part of speech, he is talking about a reality, and the reality is that whoever strives for Islam, whoever struggles in the path of Islam, they will have the victory. Therefore, the group of Allah, the soldiers of Allah, will have the victory. And the victory is for those who belongs to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, we have many verses in the Quran that talk about the victory of Islam. Why? Because the one who has created us, he made Islam as a perfect religion, as a perfect set of life. And this system, which is Islam, is taking us towards the perfection. Therefore, whoever comes against this system, they all will face failure. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi. It is the Islam, which is the religion of God, which is the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is victorious. Therefore, those who are striving in the path of Islam, those who are struggling in the path of Islam with their lives, with their money, with their efforts, with their profession, in any way, if they are helping in order to struggle, or if they are struggling in the path of Islam, they all are victorious. Even those who are killed in this way, who are martyred in this way, in the path of Allah, we call them martyr, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about them. He says, وَلَا تَحْسَبَنَّ الَّذِينَ قُتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أَمْوَاتٍ بَلْ أَحْيَاءٌ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ يُرْزَقُونَ. Don't even imagine or think about those who are killed in the path of Allah as the ones who are dead, who no more lives. Rather, they are living and they are taking their sustenance from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, this is Islam which is victorious. This is Islam which is the true religion. And we must always search for Islam in order to have Islam in the whole world, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.